Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Tonight we go big. We throw the long ball. We push all our chips into the middle. We cover some pretty strange stuff on this program, as you know, all kinds of paranormal phenomena, creatures and mysteries, things that seemingly fly in the face of science and reason. But you can take the weirdest pile of stuff we have ever mentioned on Coast, multiply it by 10, and it still isn't as strange as some of the ideas being debated on the cutting edges of mainstream science. Academic folks don't like to think of it as all that weird, certainly not in the same vein as, say, the paranormal, but I'm here to tell you it is every bit as weird and maybe more so. I'm talking about the nature of reality itself, the big enchilada, the cosmic donut, with sprinkles. At the highest levels of modern science, the debate rages about how reality is sort of put together, how it fits, how it works. The prevailing paradigm, Einsteinian relativity, is kind of familiar to most of us, E equals mc squared. We have general ideas about the speed of light, how that works. We think we understand how gravity works and what we're all made of. But the mainstream physicists have had to deal with competing ideas, quantum physics, quantum mechanics. It's a newer set of rules for how the micro world works. And the rules at the micro level don't seem to work for the macro level. Now, how can that be, you ask? And what does it mean for us? We look at a chair, we think it's a solid object, but is it? Not really. I mean, how does it stay together in a form that, you know, that allows us to sit on it without collapsing to the floor? What if I told you that physicists include in their debates the idea that free will can be expressed in scientific terms, in a formula of sorts, free will, the core of who we are and why we're here. And part of that debate focuses on whether or not our fates are predetermined. Is destiny real? Or are we like dominoes, you know, ready to fall, and there's nothing we can do to get out of the line and out of the way? I know how firsthand sort of how heated these debates get and how often they happen because I've seen them for myself. I've been eavesdropping on these intense discussions going back and forth between big brain physics gurus and world-class thinkers. And it's kind of all I can do to wrap my pointy little head around some of these ideas, but I thought the Coast audience might be the only radio audience anywhere that would get a kick out of digging into some of this same stuff. So that's what we're going to do tonight. One of the deepest of the deep thinkers is physicist and philosopher Dr. Ruth Kastner, whose new book sounds like it was written with Coast in mind, Understanding Our Unseen Reality, Solving Quantum Riddles. That's the title. And in a nutshell, what you see isn't necessarily what you get. So much of what goes on around us isn't anything. Is there anything there? It's nothing we'll ever see. And otherwise doesn't really make sense, and yet it's there. The rules of quantum mechanics sort of go right to the heart of central questions of human existence. How it all works, why we're here, what comes next. Coming up an hour from now, we jump into the heart of the debate when Dr. Kastner stops by to enlighten us about where the cosmos might be heading, and us along with it, I guess. But first, how many of you out there go to garage sales or you go searching for junk you don't need at swap meets? Maybe you shop on Craigslist. I'm one of those guys that keep an eye out for stuff I don't need, buy all kinds of junk, papers, books, things like that. Not quite as devout to say those guys are American Pickers, but not that far off from that. But in all of my searches for stuff, I've never scored something quite like this. Our first guest tonight stumbled into quite a find, a treasure chest of UFO documents. We're not talking about the rantings or scribblings of some wild-eyed researcher, but rather piles of papers from the Motherlode Project Blue Book, compiled by a military officer who once worked for the Air Force's UFO study. How this stuff ended up in the hands of my first guest is quite a tale. Rob Mercer is from the Miami Valley UFO Society. That's in Ohio. He'll join us in a few minutes to tell us what he found and how he found it. And it's kind of amazing. Our webmaster, Lex, has posted some of these materials on the Coast to Coast website so you can take a peek either before or during or after we talk to Rob Mercer. Lex and I have also put together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from news sources around the world. We call it NAPS News, and it's also found on the Coast website. A few of the stories tonight relate to our second guest, questions of quantum mechanics. One article is about a proposed experiment that would allow for confirmation or closure of certain quantum arguments. A think piece about why our everyday world does not operate according to the rules of quantum physics, or not in a way that we can see anyway. Excellent photo essay that's posted there, a legacy of Cold War photos related to the nuclear weapons program. Got a piece about how scientists are using polar regions for practice in looking for aliens. For you rock and roll fans, is there a Led Zeppelin curse, possibly linking Jimmy Page to Aleister Crowley? And finally, we have a story, maybe everybody should read this. It's sort of a polemic about anti-intellectualism in America. Agree or disagree, either way, it's a lot to chew on. I have a couple of news stories we want to cover, but I think we're going to wait until a little bit later for them. We have a lot of ground to cover tonight, so let's get to it. Not sure about your neck of the woods, but here in the desert, I think it's still about 106 degrees. Way too hot to put on a pot of Joe, but maybe pour yourself something cool to drink. Bring in the dog and cat, crank up the AC, plop down in that easy chair, and turn up the radio, because here we go. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. As I mentioned in the past on this program, when I've been sitting in the big chair here, the reason that I got hooked on the UFO subject was because of the paper trail. You know, I don't know if these things in the sky that people have been reporting for so many years are aliens or ETs. We have no idea, and there's no real proof about that one way or another. But there is proof of sorts that was enough to get me as a journalist interested, and those are the documents, the government documents that have been squeezed out of the U.S., out of the military and intelligence agencies over the years, mostly through the Freedom of Information Act. These documents, a lot of them were written before the Freedom of Information Act existed. So in it, these military folks, intelligence folks, are candid in their assessment of UFOs and UFO evidence. They'd write certain things. They had conducted secret studies, which we were never supposed to ever know about. But eventually, the law changed. The documents were made public. And we got to see a lot of the thought processes that went into how these officials looked at the UFO subject behind the scenes when somebody wasn't looking over their shoulder, most notably the public, that is. Project Blue Book, as you know, ended in 1969. And as far as we know, the U.S. government stopped all of its studies of UFOs. At least that's what they told us back then. So, you know, it every once in a while, you wonder what else they might have in their files. What do they really think? What do they really know? And my first guest tonight, Rob Mercer, got a unique kind of insight by sort of stumbling across a gigantic cache, a treasure trove of UFO documents from the Project Blue Book. And it gives him great insight into what the government was thinking back then, the kind of stuff that they were collecting. Welcome to the program, Rob Mercer. Rob?
Good evening. How are you doing?
Hey, it's good to have you here. So you're are you the head of the Miami Valley UFO Society?
I'm a MUFON field investigator from the Dayton Springfield area here in Ohio, and a couple years ago I started it just to try to get more sightings from reported, you know, to MUFON, basically to bring awareness to the area so people would report them. When we do our case investigations, you know, we always go to different websites looking for correlating cases, and I live in Springfield. I never got many cases in my area, and I would see them on other sites, so I kind of thought I would put my own site together just to try to get people to, you know, speak out to their stories. And
good group of folks?
It's not much of a group yet. I'm still working on it. It's basically just a news website, but having the local name from our area, I'm hoping it just, you know, gets people's attention so they'll report more sightings instead of letting them.
And tell me, how is it that you got interested in the topic? How long you've been chasing this stuff?
I've been interested in them since I was a kid, and I became a field investigator in early 2013. But, I mean, I've followed them my whole life. You know, we live over here see all the aircraft from Wright-Patterson flying over. I've been aware of them since I was a kid watching them. So, you know, knew the history of the area. And just always had a thing for science fiction.
Well, of course, Wright-Patterson plays a major role in the history of UFOs, the study of UFOs, including the government's study of UFOs. So is that part of why you were even on the lookout for something like this?
Well, that is. I'm a plumber by trade, and for years I worked over in the Dayton area, you know, doing house service calls in people's houses. And you'd be surprised how many people collect stuff about UFOs. You'd see books on shelves, you know, binders like I collect, you know, put together, things like that. So I always kind of kept an eye out for things like that, because eventually those things will get moved. Somebody will pass away, you know, and they'll get thrown out or whatever. So I started looking on Craigslist about 2 years ago. I thought, well, I'm going to just, you know, get on there once a week or so and just type in UFO, which is what I did and what I still do to this day.
Tell me the story.
Okay, and it was September of 2013. I'd just gotten home from one of our monthly MUFON meetings over in Columbus, about an hour away. And it was late. I still wasn't ready to go to bed, so I thought, well, I'd better do a check. I hadn't checked for a while. And it was about 11 at night, and sure enough, when I typed it in, the first thing that came up was an ad saying that a guy had Project Blue Book UFO pictures and documents. And I put the ad is on my website there if people want to see it. I made sure I screenshot it. It basically said he had binders with 8x10 photos and slides, and enough stuff to get you excited if you've seen something like that. So first thing I did was, you know, looking around the internet for hoaxes and make sure nobody was pushing something like that, and couldn't find anything. So I sent the guy a text, you know, late at night, asked if he still had them. Didn't hear from him until the next day. Emailed me back and said that he had them. Nobody had called yet, so I talked him into holding them until I'd gotten off work that evening. And drove down, and he still had them. It was down south of Dayton. And it was what he said. Pictures, case files. It was a good-sized box full of stuff.
So it's one box?
It was one box at this time. And he gave it to me. He told me he had bought them at an auction. He had bought a pile of lumber at an auction in Fairborn. Which Fairborn is more or less where Wright-Patterson's located, just a little northeast of Dayton. And which, you know, obviously, it sounded good to me. So as soon as I got home, I started rifling through everything. And, you know, I found one name. He told me it was a captain. I found a name of a lieutenant on them, on a lot of the documents, a lot of the memos and the briefings, you know, from the late 60s. So I instantly went about trying to make sure that nothing was stolen, you know, nothing was gotten illegally, making sure that the name matched up. Basically, I was trying to find a house that had an auction a few months before.
So that's the story that the guy told you? He said he bought it with a bunch of lumber?
Yeah.
Lumber?
Bought a pile of lumber, and the box was in it. He was loading the lumber up, and the box was underneath of it. So he took that with him. I guess as I put the story together afterwards, you know, I tracked down it. It was a lieutenant. I found out that he had lived in a house, and there was a guy on the papers. He had lived in a house in Fairborn that had been sold a few years before. But there was an auction there, you know, a month or so before, which fit the guy's story. Didn't know if it was the right one, but, you know, everything's lining up as it looks. So I did a drive down to the house, and sure enough, it was a two-story garage, you know, just kind of with an attic top, the kind of place where you store stuff and, you know, not go and see it for a long time. So I was pretty sure I was on the right track, you know, of everything being there. But even then, I was able to get his phone number and where he was currently living. But I really didn't have the nerve to go up and approach him and I wanted to let him know I had everything just so I didn't get him in trouble. But I also didn't want to lose what I had. Didn't want to have to give it up. So I kind of sat on him for about 6 months. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was former military. He suggested, you know, maybe I ought to contact him. I was former military, and maybe I could break the ice. So I gave him his phone number, and he made a phone call for me. And turned out the lieutenant and his wife had gotten a divorce a couple years before that. And that's when they had moved out of the house, and he moved out of state.
So did he mean for this stuff to go, to be let go?
No, he did not at the time. My friend gave him a call. His ex-wife was nice enough to give us his phone number. My friend gave him a call where he lived, and then he called me back a few minutes later and told me that the lieutenant wanted me to give him a call. So, you know, a little hesitant, and I still went ahead and gave him a call. I figured I need to get it over with. And as we talked, I explained, you know, where I got him, how I got him, and he was surprised he'd left him behind when he moved out. So we, you know, talked on the subject for a few hours, subject and, you know, just general politics. Turned out he had, and when he left in 1969, he put all, you know, everything away, and just he hadn't thought about UFOs since then and wasn't messing with them too much. But he, seeing how interested I was in the subject, and told me, you know, told me that as much, and basically said, you know, when I get back home to where I live in the summer, he said, I've got three or four more boxes of that stuff if you're interested in it.
Oh, boy.
He said, I can just send them to you. And I said, well, yeah, yeah. I said, well, what do you want for me? He said, I don't want anything. He said, I'm getting old. And he said, I just, you know, when we was cleaning up there, these were stuff out the desk, stuff we was working on. And just, he said he took it home with him at the time. Thought he might, you know, look at it eventually, but he had no interest in getting back into it. So he, you know, told me to give him a call, you know, in a month or so. He gave me a different phone number. I waited. I gave him a little more time than that. I didn't want to appear to be a pest or anything to him. And he, eventually, I called him about 2 months later. He remembered everything and said he was going to sort through everything and get the trash out of it and send it to me. Well, I told him, you know, don't do any of that. I like, the trash is good.
Yeah.
I want everything you got. So
yeah.
He went ahead and boxed everything up, which was fairly expensive to ship to me from where he was at. And that's where I ended up getting a lot of the files. Files, books. Basically, this was just one of the box. He had a stack of those boxes, and somehow this one got overlooked when he moved. The first one that I had bought on Craigslist. But it led me to getting the other three boxes.
So four boxes altogether.
Four boxes altogether. They're full of, well, you see a lot of the pictures on my website of the contents in them. Some of them were complete files. Some of them in original file folders. Some of them were just loose paper. I mean, there's a lot of loose papers that have taken me a while to somewhat sort. I'm not claiming I have everything sorted the exact way it should be. But there's correspondences, documents, memos, publications, papers. That, like, I got a paper here from Kent Nilla that he had written on UFOs. Different people on the staff would write, like, essays, basically, about the UFOs. I got statistics, notes, reference notes, film, slides. Quite a bit of stuff in it. And I'd call him from time to time and ask him questions about it, but he has a, you know, real hard time remembering specifics about anything.
We'll cover some of the material in the files after the break. I'm just wondering, so the guy from Craigslist, did you have to buy the first box from him, or he just gave it to you?
No. He was selling it for $100.
Okay.
I gave him what he wanted.
It's lucky he didn't realize how much you might have been willing to pay for it.
Yeah, I was happy to get out of there with what I had. I was afraid somebody else was going to come and want them.
Is the name of the ex-military guy, are you making that public, or are you keeping that to yourself?
He told me I could. I haven't said it too often just because I don't really want him to get pestered or anything, but, I mean, I can. His name was Lieutenant Carmen Morano. He was there from, best I can tell, late 66 until they shut down.
Oh.
And he was... basically right under I know I'm saying Quintanilla's name wrong, but
that's pretty close. Yeah, he was right under him, right?
he was his second in command there, the other officer on staff at the time. And he was I've got a lot of documents from different briefings and things he would go to. He was also tasked with sorting the files out, organize them. When he got there, they were a little bit messy. And he told me that a lot of this was put together, a lot of the files were put together for the press at the time.
Sure.
When he got there, the press was always coming in wanting to see stuff, and he thought he'd make them a little more organized, putting them in the binders, which that, if you look at the ad, you'll see that one of those binders with pictures in it. So he put all that together, and he said at the time, Quintanilla, you know, was on him about it, basically saying they, you know, they're always out to get us, don't do anything to help them.
They're out to get us?
Well, you know, just arguing with them, disagreeing with everything they said, basically, is what he was insinuating. But he, at Murano, organized everything up, fixed it, and the press loved it. They loved it. They can get in there. It just had an organization to it. It was easy to find things. And he told me that Quintanilla tried to take claim credit for it, even though he was against doing it.
I'll tell you what, Rob Mercer, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to delve into a little more about what is in the specific files, and you can tell us what the attitude of this Lieutenant Murano was toward the job that he was assigned to. Deep Purple from Black Knight takes us into the break. This is a 1970 hit. Maybe you remember it. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast after this. Let the Day Begin is the name of that song. The band is The Call. Couple of rockers out of Santa Cruz. That's where the band formed anyway. And what I understand is Bono of U2 was singing background vocals on that song. And that never fails to get my my knee popping and always gets the blood pumping. Good song. We're talking with Rob Mercer about this cache, this treasure trove of UFO documents from Project Blue Book that he sort of stumbled across, and his efforts to get a little bit more information from the Air Force officer who was working on Project Blue Book right up until the end. We'll continue our conversation, then we'll open up the phone lines. Maybe Rob wants to stick around and answer a couple of your questions during his first ever visit to Coast. Much more to come here. Stick around. Welcome back. We're talking with Rob Mercer about this pile of UFO documents from Project Blue Book that found their way into his possession. He's with the Miami Valley UFO Society. He's a field investigator for MUFON. So I can imagine, Rob, how thrilled you were to be able to go through all this stuff. Have you read every page, I would imagine, by now? You've looked at all of it, looking for, see if there's a hidden secret smoking gun that somehow got through?
I have visually scanned every page. Obviously, I don't know everything that's on every one of them. Still got a long way to go there.
Oh.
But, I mean, the first thing I went looking for was obviously the estimate of the situation.
Right.
Seeing if there was any references to it.
Well, tell people about that. That's like the mother lode. That would be, it's a document that was supposedly destroyed, right? All copies were destroyed.
Right. That's what they said, and it was supposedly, you know, they admitted that the existence of extraterrestrials on there. Ruppelt had mentioned it in his book, but I've only found it mentioned twice in these files. One of the time, well, I got both of them actually up on my webpage. One of them is a correspondence from somebody to a former member of Blue Book asking them about it, and he basically towed the company line on that one and said the same thing. It was destroyed. He'd never seen it. But then there was a lot of these blue reference cards in these files, and they're basically, you know, what they would, when they're typing up their cases, what they would look at, or if they were asked a question, what their answer was supposed to be, I'm assuming. And I've stuck that on there too. It's another copy of the estimate of the situation.
Oh.
They're saying something different about it. They're saying that it was, I'm trying to find a page here, just a second. All right, I got it on my website. But people can see it if they go on there.
Yeah, I'll just mention that for those who are not familiar with the estimate of the situation, it's sort of, for UFO researchers, it's sort of like the Ark of the Covenant. It's like the Golden Fleece. There was a project before Blue Book, there was something called Project Sign, which studied UFOs. And supposedly the team from Project Sign came up with a final report that said, we think that these are intelligently controlled craft, that they're from somewhere else, that they weren't made here on Earth. They submit this report to, I think it was General Hoyt Vandenberg, who said, I'm not going to let this out. I'm not going to sign off on this. Send it back, destroy these copies, and come up with something else. So everybody ever since they've heard about this has been just dying to read it, if assuming that any copy ever survived.
And I've not found any in here. And I asked the lieutenant about it. He had knew nothing about it, he said. So that was one of the first things I went looking for.
Tell me this about the lieutenant. Do you get any sense from him? I mean, is he opening up to you? Would he tell you what he thought about this assignment? Because I know that some of the people who were assigned to work on Project Blue Book, they were disgusted by it. They thought it was a dead end, bad for their career, wanted nothing to do with it, and were pretty angry about the whole thing. How did he feel about it?
When he went into it, he grew up a fan of science fiction. So when he went into the program, he told me he was going to prove they were real, to himself anyway. And after being there, you know, his 2 years, a little over 2 years, he was convinced otherwise, he told me. He basically, it wasn't what I wanted to hear, but he said he left, you know, the program thinking, knowing they're out there, but just not believing that they're coming, wasting their time coming to see us, is what he told me.
Wasting their time coming to see us.
Wasting their resources. He said they got more important things to do. So that's basically, if you look at all, you know, a lot of the Blue Book cases, especially a lot of the photos, especially if you want to even say that, the ones I have, because they were put together for the press, so obviously they're not going to be the best ones. You can see where a person, especially with a short staff, would get burnout on the subject. I mean, it's just doing what we do here, you know, investigating for MUFON, it's tough. You know, you get a lot of, you know, just lights in the sky type things, and they had a lot of that. And he was discouraged from, he was never allowed to go out and actually physically investigate anything. He was strictly stuck there at the office. Even if he, you know, seen one he wanted to go out on.
The allegation that Blue Book is primarily a public relations exercise, that it was really meant to explain this stuff away, give something out to the press, lessen public's interest in it, don't actually do any real work. I mean, that sort of is reinforced by what you're telling me here.
Well, I don't...
Yes and no?
This is my opinion. I don't think that the Blue Book guys were in on that so much. I think the guys like him were... I asked him what he thought, because, you know, that's what I asked him that same question. And he said when he worked there, he never believed that the better ones went over him. You know, he thought they got everything. But he said, given what he knows about the government now, anything's possible. That was his answer on that one.
And Hector Quintanilla, his commanding officer, you described him, I think, in very briefly in the last segment, as sort of combative. He was kind of,
putting the books together for the press.
Right.
I mean, he said they got along. He was a real good guy. Matter of fact, he asked me what, you know, I wonder what old Quint's doing these days. Of course, I let him know that he died in 98. But he said he got along with him pretty good. He didn't get along with Hynek real well. As a matter of fact, I was telling him that in Hynek's book, he wrote had a couple paragraphs about, or at least a paragraph about the lieutenant at the end. Basically, the lieutenant must have told him that he didn't like his job. Thought he was should be doing something else. And then, you know, I was telling the lieutenant about that quote in the book, and he was really surprised because him and Hynek never got along, he said.
I think when I first went through your stuff, scanned it in connection with getting ready for this interview, I remember some comments related to Alan Hynek. Of course, he was the civilian scientific advisor to Blue Book. He went into it as sort of the designated explainer, the guy who would debunk UFO sightings. He's the one who came up with the explanation of swamp gas for a series of UFO sightings, I think, in Michigan. And then he changed. Over the years, his attitude changed dramatically. I think at one point in your files, it had something to the effect of Hynek saying, UFOs will disappear. In a couple of years, Cold War nerves will be gone. This will all be gone. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. And that is in here. And I've tried to look for that line when Hynek kind of started switching. And the lieutenant, like I said, he was there since 66. To him, Hynek always thought everything was unidentified. He would keep the cases real long. So somewhere between 64 and there is when he did his kind of changeover. On the Socorro case, he was kind of the other way on that.
Is there anything, I don't know if you've made a comparison between what we know publicly from Project Blue Book, what's been made public, and what you have in those boxes. Is there anything that's in your boxes and files that is not in the public Blue Book file, or do you know?
Well, I've got a few things so far. First, nothing in these files is redacted at all. And, you know, Murano actually made a point to tell me, remember, you know, people's names are on those. Watch what you put out there and show people. So I try to, you know, keep that the best I can, not really show a lot of things like that. But nothing is redacted in these. I'm looking at a few. Keep in mind, I got a long way to go, and I don't have a lot of time, free time to do it, and cross-reference and everything. But I'm going to take one case in particular, and it's the Socorro, New Mexico case, 64. It was about 200 pages long, the one that I had. It was one of the few that was actually all bound together. Came with 11 photos plus a mock-up photo. And I went page for page. When the Black Vault was online,
yes,
with their Blue Book files, I went page for page just comparing to see if I had anything that they didn't have. And they had a couple sketches that I didn't have, which I found, you know, what I was a little upset about. But I did find I have a lot of handwritten notes that were, they're copies of them. They're copied and stapled together in this book, but they're handwritten notes that aren't included in the Blue Book files that you find there at the National Archives site. And then there's, I got a lot of their basically all their research tools that they used, their books, contacts, Rolodex with people's names in them, addresses.
You mentioned film. What's have you looked at the film?
Oh yeah, yeah. I have a 1952 Tremonton, Utah film.
Oh wow, that's a big one.
Very brittle. I tried to copy it myself and didn't, so I had to end up driving several hours to have it copied. The quality is terrible on it, though. I don't know if it's from the age of the film. There's a lot of scratches in it. I was hoping that it would have the extra 20 feet that Officer Newhouse said was missing when he got his back from the Air Force. I've seen reports of that. It's inconclusive just because it's such a bad picture. You can't. It's hard to see on it. Hmm. I don't know if it's possible for me to have it cleaned, if I even want to.
I've kind of... I'll tell you what, Rob, I'm going to ask around about that. We'll see if we can get you some help. I'm surprised the MUFON National Organization hasn't come to your aid and volunteered to help you out.
Yeah, I haven't really, you know, pushed on them that much about that. I've kind of just kind of do this on my own. But, yeah, I'm wondering if that can be done. I know it ends with somebody soldering something at a table, which, you know, I've never seen that before on any of the videos, copies of it you can see online. But it's inconclusive. There was a video of the Moline, Officer Fisher's Moline, Moline, Illinois sighting 1967. Basically, they're out shoveling snow, and it shows a white object in the sky, which he described as big as a boxcar. It's a 8 millimeter film. The Air Force ended up saying it was a balloon. But at that same time, there were several unidentifieds in that area, you know, in the Blue Book files that came back. There's a microfilm of a meteor report. I've not really had a chance to put it on yet. There was a couple other ones, but one that the lieutenant was excited to send me, he mentioned when he was describing some of the stuff he had, was a film of Quintanilla. It just said, he grabbed it out of the desk when they were cleaning up, and it just said Quintanilla on it. It was from a TV station in Virginia. So I did have that one copied. I had to go a good distance. It's a 16 millimeter with sound, and had a hard time finding people that would transfer it for me. But it's an interview with Quintanilla about the Socorro sighting.
Oh.
So it's, and I have it on my website. It's at the very bottom. I kind of got hit a little bit, but it's at the very bottom of the Blue Book page.
Hey, let's take a couple of quick calls here, Rob. There's folks on the line with questions for you. We got Blair and Sedona on the wild card line. Hi, Blair. You're on with Rob Mercer.
Hey, thanks, George. Mr. Mercer, when you got on, it reminded me of Shirley MacLaine's Saging While Aging book, where she described the U.S. meeting two distinct alien groups in the mid-50s. And I'm wondering, in your researching of these files, if there will be some government documentation delineating the changeover from what I term the 1950s beautiful human aliens of the George Adamski and Daniel Fry genre, to the bug-eyed, spindly, sometimes insectoid, and worker clones of the Whitley Strieber, Communion, David Jacobs genre. You sort of get where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I do. And I've not found anything that really describes any aliens or what they look like at all. I mean, everything that I'm finding denies them. I can only take what's in the book, or what I have and tell you, but that's all I've found so far. But I've not read page for page yet, though.
Blair, thanks for the call. We got Rod in Hermosa Beach on the wild card line. Hi, Rod.
Hey there, George. Greetings and good evening to you, and good morning to you, Mr. Mercer.
Thank
you, Rod. Very quick comment, George. I just want to say that I thought you did a masterful job last night interviewing Dr. Davis. I could just imagine that as an interviewer, sometimes it's incredibly difficult to translate an academics kind of like way of presenting his material into a popular radio format. I thought you did a great job with that interview.
Well, I appreciate that. You got something in mind for Rob?
I sure do. I wanted to ask Mr. Mercer here if, upon a careful reading of this massive treasure trove of documents that you have, unredacted documents, if you found any reference at all to what might be thought of as an MJ-12 or larger sort of meta organization that that is really running the UFO show, so to speak. Now, I personally think MJ-12 here is a forgery by public enemy number one, Richard Doty, right? But I think there may be such an organization that exists, and I'm wondering, especially since you have the unredacted files, is there anything in there that might point the way to another sort of government agency over Blue Book and sort of like getting the really good cases?
I found a document, and I can't right offhand tell you which one it was, that mentioned the Project White Stork. And I've tried to look up information on it, but it seemed to be almost a CIA UFO investigation. It just mentioned that about a case being sent to Project White Stork. So that I'd found it, and it's one that I've got a note on somewhere to get back to when I get some free time. But
thanks.
I don't know if anybody knows anything about that particular one, but that one has caught my eye.
That doesn't ring a bell, but I'm going to ask around about it. Thanks, Rod. Try to get one more quick call in west of the Rockies. Richard in Concord, California. Hi, Richard. You're on with Rob Mercer.
Hi, Mr. Knapp. Yeah,
hi,
Mr. Knapp. I want to say that you're my first choice as a replacement for Mr. Norrie. Glad to have you aboard.
Thanks.
Mr. Mercer, my question is, how much of a connection is there between our government and these aliens or whatever? Because I'm seeing different things on YouTube. I'm seeing the hole in the Antarctica. I'm seeing aliens living below the Earth. I'm seeing Mount Shasta and a secret base and all this kind of stuff. I would just like to know, what's the connection between our government and the aliens, and what are the good ones and what are the bad ones? I'm hearing this.
Hey, Richard, I'm gonna stop you. Richard, I'm going to interrupt you there. I appreciate where you're heading with it, but I think that's a little bit beyond what Rob is talking about. He's just sharing with us stories about what's in the Blue Book files, and I think that's beyond what we're here to talk about. But thank you for calling in anyway. I appreciate it. Rob, there's not
found anything like that in there.
Yeah, it's pretty cut and dried stuff. I mean, it's Project Blue Book after all. They're not tackling those kind of mysteries, right?
Oh, right. Now, one other thing I failed to mention on that Socorro case, there was, like I said, 11 decent photos in there, and a mock-up you've probably seen on my website. But nobody, I have no idea who put it together, if it was Air Force or a fan of it sent it in. But another thing, I was introduced to Ray Stanford, which I know you interviewed him a few months ago.
Yes.
And I was looking at one of his books and seen that symbol, that, you know, the insignia that he had, with the inverted V with the three lines through it. And as looking at his book and seeing that, I remembered seeing it in my book. And on some of those handwritten notes that I was telling you about, they had the Air Force had drawn that out and wrote about it a little bit. Basically, they have the sentence, you know, the paragraph saying that Sergeant Chavez told Lonnie Zamora to change the insignia. But then at the bottom, you know, they said it didn't. It's not really what happened, but they took the time to write that down. And that's one of the things that I've not seen in what's available in the public. I know Ray's caught a lot of flack over the years for that insignia saying that, you know, it was out there. And I'm not saying one way or another if that was the truth, but it is in the files.
Rob, I appreciate you coming on here and talking to us about your big score. It is a big score. It's important stuff. Unfiltered sort of files that are not included in the official released Blue Book stuff. I mean, that's an amazing find. It's really important. I'm surprised that sort of the poobahs of ufology haven't come forward and offered to help you out a little bit.
Well, I've talked to a lot of guys. They're reaching out to me, and I'll share stuff with them. I'm using them to help me figure out what's in a lot of them. You know, sending digital copies here and there, and it's an ongoing job of searching through them, and hopefully if there's a next time, I'll have a little more information for you.
Yeah, we can do that another time. I enjoyed reading some of the cartoons from back in the day, you know, how the media looked at this stuff.
Yeah, they had it's a good collection. That was all in one folder, all those that you see there, and there's a couple hundred of them in it.
Well, thanks for sharing it with us. We'll have you back on another time, and I hope people will check out the links that we put on the Coast website and take a look at your material. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Coming up, we're shifting gears. Dr. Ruth Kastner, author of the new book, Understanding Our Unseen Reality, Solving Quantum Riddles. Good stuff right around the corner. The Birds take us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.